The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly, your destination for technology news and views from the crack team at The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky, and I'm joined today by pod regulars Jemima Kish, Charles Arthur, and Bobby Johnson. Welcome to the show. This week, I've mostly been amazed at the places technology will take you. No, not to outer space or even to fictitious worlds, but on stage at Glastonbury, exactly where I'll be heading next week to sing a song accompanied by the PlayStation 3 SingStar video game. And Jemima. Yes, Jemima and I will be taking to the stage immediately after Kate Nash. I don't think the shock has sunk in yet. I don't think it's sunk in. Seriously.
Whoa.
Ah,
no. You're going to be on Radio 1.
Can you adopt a Mockney accent as well, please?
Cool blimey, Mary Oppins. How's that? Well, if you weren't able to get tickets to this festival, you might want to try your luck on the music game Guitar Hero, because top performers will win a place in the lineup at the Isle of Wight Festival. Which I think, you know, there's loads of new things that
following in the
on
steps of Jimi Hendrix. Incredible.
In the meantime, we've got a chocka show for you today, including both the nitty and the gritty from Kevin Rose, founder of social aggregating websites Dig and Pounce, and many others. We're also interviewing MySpace co-founder Tom Anderson about the service's new look and all the questions you wanted us to ask. Keep listening to find out what he has to say about their future demographic, their plans for new dimensions, and whether they indeed are the next big thing. All this, plus the new your views from the blogs, and a forward shout to Thursday's technology section, and an interview with the organizers from the forthcoming Mashed-Un conference in London. Keep tuned to Tech Weekly or be hopelessly obsolete in less than an hour. Being a serial web entrepreneur is demanding, but being serial web entrepreneur and digital personality Kevin Rose is even more so. The co-founder of Dig and Pounce, presenter of the Dig Nation podcast and Tech TV's Attack of the Show, and Business Week cover girl recently spoke with Zoe Margolis about staying at the top of the game with Dig, his most famous property. She began by asking how his social news aggregator has changed media consumption forever.
Dig to me is obviously, because we've kind of leveled the playing field, we accept all different types of content, whether it's sources from CNN or The Guardian or you name it, or a little blog in the middle of nowhere, we'll accept those types of submissions. So really it's about seeing what the masses want to surface, which articles they are finding the most interesting, and oftentimes they unearth and promote stories to the front page that you wouldn't find anywhere else, that would really be buried on a traditional news site. So to me, it's kind of that distinct flavor of the community that gets me excited about going back to the front page. But absolutely, I mean, it's my front page. That's not to mean that I don't go off and surf my favorite, tech blogs or salon.com.
So do you think Dig eventually then can take over from mainstream media as a source of information and news?
I don't think so. I mean, we're always going to be dependent upon the quality reporting of mainstream media. And I think that what we will accomplish is that Dig will be a platform in which users can say, I'm enjoying something and I want to syndicate that and push it to people I care about. So, when you dig an article and you say, I like it, not only are you just increasing that vote by one and helping promote to the front page, but you're also saying, like, this is a platform for me to spread this information to my friends. So if you define your social graph on Dig, it'll spread it out to those people. If you have integration with Facebook right now that we launched recently, and you dig a story, it'll push that story into your mini feed, which syndicates to your main news feed, it goes to all your friends. So you'll see us working deeper partnerships in those areas, and just kind of really turning Dig into a verb. Dig is the way, the method and the action that you take on something in order to spread it to the people you care about.
Well, with that in mind, then, can it keep its unique selling point?
We're getting better and better at really kind of diversifying the front page and bringing in more different types of content. And in the long term, we're developing algorithms that take a look at what you've dug and compare it to other people on inside the system in real time. Dig will not serve also as a means of gathering metrics for third-party websites, providing them insights into who's digging their content, who they're spreading it to. We want to enable publishers to have a better idea of which authors are the most popular on their site, which content types are striking a chord with their readers, and I think that we'll provide those tools for them.
So speaking of third parties, do you think, is the future of Dig not in and moving away from the computer, you know, to mobile technology like Twitter, for example. Is that a little smaller?
We're looking at ways of digging all different types of content. I mean, right now it's bound to web-based articles where it's news, videos, images, you know, that type of stuff. But that doesn't mean, I mean, I think that dig is saying, this is something that I'm into, this is something that I care about, this is something I want to share with other people, can be applied to pretty much anything in the world. So, see.
Where does dig go from here?
I think it's just more customization, more knowing who you are as an individual. Not really that random one dig and like, I like this and I want to move on to the other RAM story, but saying, yes, here's the random stuff, but here's the structured stuff based on who you are and who is also like you finding cool stuff. So, and also getting a little bit more into the niches. You know, if I dig a lot of stories about, you know, Debian Linux and, say, oolong tea, Dig will know that and connect me with those types of stories. Even if they're not the most popular stories in the world, but they're still interesting articles for me to read, I should be getting those from Dig.
And the future, the money question, which everyone I'm sure keeps asking you, I mean, is it going to be like on the stock market? Is somebody going to own it? Are you going to sell it on?
I like the fact that we're lightweight right now. You know, if there's something, there's an idea that I have in the shower, you know, at 6 in the morning, I can take it into our product meeting and we can turn it into a project and launch it in 3 months, you know, and that to me feels really good. I don't have to deal with a lot of overhead. But that said, you know, if there ever becomes a partner that can, you know, help us get to our goals and where, you know, 2 + 2 = 10, then that's something that I consider. So right now we're happy going out alone.
Do you have the same sort of ambitions for Dig that say there is a place of, you know, that this is kind of internationally, you know, globe-spanning kind of company?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, you'll see us expand internationally into other language areas eventually. You know, we're a small team still, and I think the stuff initiatives you'll see us kick off sometime this year. But yeah, no doubt. I mean, we want to bring this to as many places as we possibly can, and we think that you know, a kind of democratic approach to news is a very valuable thing for all people and all countries, and we'll get there eventually.
That was Zoe Margolis with Dig's Kevin Rose. So Kevin talks about sharing sites with friends as the next big thing and all these algorithms behind the service as their biggest killer app. But social searching like this, is, I mean, it's been around for a while. In the way that he talks about it, he seems to think that he's going to be able to topple Google. Does social searching have the capacity and the capability to do such?
Potentially it does, but I've never seen anyone who can deliver on it properly in the kind of scale that you'd need. And I also think a lot of people use Dig not as a community that much. They just go and they look at a bunch of stories. I think actually the active population is a lot smaller than the overall population. So in social search, you really depend upon those kind of those seekers and the people who find information, and then it starts spreading out from there. And that's what social search has never done at scale.
It just doesn't scale, you know. Compared to machines, you can scale machines, you just put more of them in. Whereas social stuff, you need more people and you need to keep it growing. You know, it's why pyramid schemes break down. I'm not calling Dig a pyramid scheme by any sort of sense, Mr. Rose's lawyers. It's more the fact that, you know, if you need to find more people, if you need to get the social search to work really well, you need more and more people, and you just can't keep them all going in the same direction.
It's interesting to see or to hear Google being mentioned. And, you know, is Google going to be knocked off the top spot? Because there has been some speculation that Google is looking at buying Dig. Dig's been sort of touted around by Allen and partners. Yeah, just, you know, can anyone buy Dig, please? You know, because these guys want an exit. It's not inconceivable that, Google might buy.
Because Yahoo did buy Delicious, which Indeed. Is another yeah. social search sort of idea.
I would also point out that Brad Horowitz, who was the head of advanced development at Yahoo, who bought Flickr and Delicious and those kind of things, has now moved to Google. I had a long talk with him a couple of years ago about how they thought social search was the future and all that kind of stuff at Yahoo. I wouldn't be surprised to see that he's taking the same ideas elsewhere.
Well, Dig has a much richer community than Delicious.
Of teenage boys, largely.
I do find that I just skip through Dig and I go to some of the other social search sites. But, you know, who is their demographic? Is it teenage boys? Is that their community? Where can I find a social search that's right for me?
Well, a while ago, I was in San Francisco and went to see them in their office and talked to them at length about this. And we published some stuff on the website. And Jay Adelson, who's the CEO and the kind of the more the business brains behind it, explained that, you know, they want to come up with all these verticals and they want to allow social search to mean that you don't have to interact with the griefers and the teenage kids on there if you don't want to. And they're also talking about open sourcing a lot of it as well to enable other people to go and build this stuff rather than them having to spend all their time doing it themselves and getting shit for it, really. Yeah. So I think, you know, we'll see a lot of developments there.
Well, you can read more about this story and more on the new internet celebrities like Kevin, including Kevin's Dignation partner in crime, Alex Albrecht, who you interviewed for the weekend section.
Yeah, we did. You know, they're nice guys. They're, you know, and that's why they appeal to those teenage kids, is that they're kind of slightly clean cut, but a bit edgy, successful geeks that kids can relate to, I think.
Well, you can read more about them and more about this story in particular on guardian.co.uk/technology. Now here's Jemima practicing for her Glastonbury debut by putting on her most dulcet tones with her rendition of the news.
You're all evil.
Ah!
Yahoo appeared to blow any chance of a Microsoft acquisition out of the water by announcing a 10-year deal with Google to outsource some of its advertising. Effectively admitting it cannot compete with Google in search advertising, Yahoo will make $100 million a year from the deal, but the industry reacted badly to the move. Gary McKinnon, the British computer hacker who cracked the Pentagon and NASA, has taken his case against extradition to the House of Lords. His lawyers claim the US has abused the process by making threats about what will happen to him if he does not agree to plead guilty. Associated Press kicked off another round of the ongoing battle with bloggers over fair use of copyrighted content, issuing a takedown notice to Drudge Retort over 7 posts, which quoted up to 79 words of AP stories. Bloggers including Jeff Jarvis and Michael Arrington threatened to boycott AP content, while AP itself appeared to backtrack and admitted it had been a little heavy-handed.
Thanks, Jemima. Great vocal tone there. It will sound incredible to our audience next Friday. Very, very good.
Stop it.
No, you're coming
mean.
On stage with me.
I'm going to be so hanging out at the cider bus for about 6 hours before I do that.
And that's where you can find Jemima before on stage at the Queen's Head on Friday night. But anyway, moving on. Let's talk a little bit about this AP Drudge Retort story. What's going on there, Jemima?
Well, it's not the first time that there's been a spat between news organisations and then internet entities about their use of content. And this is actually the third case that AP's been involved in or has initiated. So Drudge Retort, which is different to the Drudge Report, this is a kind of left-wing discussion site, is, in my opinion, a fairly responsible user of news stories. I mean, they were only quoting short excerpts of stories and then having a very healthy discussion, which most of us would think is a very responsible way to use news stories. And in a lot of cases, obviously, that drives a lot of traffic back to the host websites.
What I experience when I'm checking to see what people have written about on their blogs about technology stories is that I do a search on the various blog search engines, and from time to time I come across things where people have taken entire 1,000-word pieces, 800-word pieces, plus the photos sometimes, and just stuck it on their blog. And, you know, I try to say as nicely as I can, actually, that's not really what we're looking for. We're not looking for you to take the entire thing. You know, if you want to comment on it, if you want to criticise it, you know, using parts of it, that falls under the fair use part of the law, as it applies in the States.
Yeah, that's certainly the discussion when it comes to what people understand about what blogging is versus what reporting is. But ultimately, the question is Jeff Jarvis saying F you to AP? You like how I do that? Does this actually make any difference?
He's just saying this should be a sensible use of your content.
Well, what's interesting about that, just with reference to The Guardian, is that there have been a series of lunchtime and evening discussions that have been talking a bit about the future of journalism. And I know that Baba, you and Jemima have been covering those, so there's more information on that at blogs.guardian.co.uk/digital-content. But moving on to the other story that I wanted to talk about was the Gary McKinnon extradition case. Bobby, you seem to have quite a bit of information in your head about this.
This is a very long, ongoing story. Gary was accused of hacking into computers belonging to the US military, the Pentagon, and lots of organisations. And he didn't really cause any damage. But what happens in these cases is that the organisation has to spend a lot of money working out where it went wrong and working out what he might have done. So Gary doesn't really deny that he did any of these things. What he says is that he shouldn't be extradited to the US to face criminal charges there, because everything he did is covered by the Computer Misuse Act of 1990 in the UK. Now, the real reason behind this is that in the UK, the punishments are relatively lenient. In the US, he could be classed as a terrorist, effectively, and thrown into Guantanamo Bay. So, you know, they're arguing about the extremes of the case and saying, sorry, we don't want McKinnon to go to America because he's an enemy combatant in that case and could get imprisoned for, you know, for his entire life for hacking into the Pentagon because he thought aliens existed, which is basically what he did.
Well, then there's definitely going to be more coverage of this on The Guardian's website, whether it's in the legal pages, as we were thinking before, or even in technology. Well, you can read more about these and get your technology news fix anytime at guardian.co.uk/technology. Not many people can claim to have 110 million friends, but Tom Anderson, co-founder of MySpace, has the data to back him up. Tom's grinning gob has been on the profiles of every person who signed up to the site, a ready-made friend for anyone who's traipsed down the path of social networking. Now, MySpace, once the leader of the pack in this area, has witnessed serious competition over the past few years, which has redirected attentions elsewhere on the web. Tom hopes that a revamped site will re-establish their lead and make them the hub of networking again. Jemima, what's the story here?
Well, it's not a really radical overhaul. They've tweaked their TV player a bit. They've improved some of the search functions on the site. We thought it would be quite interesting to ask our readers and our Twitter followers what they wanted to ask Tom. The first question is from Steve Lawson, who asked, are they ever planning a complete site overhaul to bring the back end up to date?
Yes, actually, this plan began in September of last year, and we expect to be done in about 3 to 4 months. And the back end overhaul has been something that's been going on for quite a long time. We're gradually moving the entire site from ColdFusion into .NET. There's a few areas of the site, none of the key ones, that are still in ColdFusion, which is sort of a monster task to make that scale. I would say we're probably about 6 months away from the back end being entirely overhauled.
So we have Gaurav, who asks, how do you plan to fight spam? Comments, friend requests, and messages are mostly spam. Hardly an intimate place to communicate with friends.
Right. That's been my number one concern for quite a while. Back in September, actually, we launched a number of different features that allow you to block most things. If you turn them on, if you go into your account settings and check the spam tab, there's all sorts of things that you can do to make it so you won't get spammed. We've also started working with a company that sort of scans the email in a way that you'd find in a Yahoo or Google, you know, a spam filter. And we're probably launching that within the next 3 weeks. But we've actually reduced the number of complaints dramatically over the last 3 to 4 months and over the last year. So even though it's always a number one concern of mine, the problem has largely been curtailed.
Ben Perot, who I happen to know used to work for NME.com and now he's at Sky, he said, please drill him on music. How will it work? Will we really get all music for free? How will it be paid for? Pre-rolls, display?
Yeah, so it is an ad-based model. You really will get all the music for free. We're trying to get basically everything that you'd find in the iTunes catalog, you know, every major label band, to have their entire discography on the site. It's not pre-roll, it's ads that are along with it, so you're not having to listen to anything. There's, you know, it's just the music is there and there's ads next to it, and that's the idea. I'm not sure exactly when it's rolling out in the UK. In the US, we'll be launching in about 2 or 3 months, still working on some of the licensing deals to make it fly here in the UK.
Excellent, and actually related to that, Jonas Woost asked, how are you going to work with independent labels?
That's somewhat of an open question. We're trying to see what's through some of the bigger aggregators, if we can get them on the same platform and using what we're doing now. We will also be opening up the number of songs that they can upload. So if the independents want to just upload more tracks, they'll be able to. But right now, trying to figure it out, it's quite difficult because there's so many of them. And, you know, one of the easy things about this deal is that it was for, you know, major labels that we did the joint venture with and or tried to, and there's so many independents, it's not exactly clear how we'll be able to do that, but it is a focus for the music joint venture.
So there are aggregators like The Orchard and stuff, are those the kind of people you'd be thinking about?
Right, yeah. That and just, you know, major labels that have independents underneath them, that sort of thing.
Okay, this might be slightly more of a UK-focused question. It's something of a national obsession, but Dick Deekster asked, does he think there is a genuine class divide between MySpace, brackets, blue collar, and Facebook, brackets, college? And if so, is that bad?
It's hard to say. I mean, in the U.S. in particular, I know the stats, and we have more, you know, so many more people in the U.S. than Facebook does, that we actually have, you know, more college-educated people than they do, and we have more wealthy people than they do. But there is a difference in that they have only those people. So it's sort of like you'll find more of every type of person on MySpace in the U.S. In the U.K., I'm not exactly sure. And whether it's good or bad, I don't really know. I think, you know, MySpace is definitely has a populist feel to it, and I like that. It's something I like about it, that you can see all types on the site. Facebook can feel a little sterile to me at times, and I'm not sure if that's the reason, but I guess I'd leave that to him to say whether it's good or bad.
Okay. Alex Bellinger, this is an interesting question. How important will data portability be to MySpace and its users in 12 months' time?
I have mixed feelings on this one. I think it's a tech issue. Tech people love to talk about it more than it is a social issue or a user issue. And by that, what I mean is I'm not sure how many users will really benefit from it or want to do it. And it sort of depends on the other tech companies out there. If Yahoo wants to do it and eBay wants to do it and they carry forward on the joint announcements we've made and they integrate them in a way that's really meaningful to users, then we probably will see a big impact on it. So I think it both depends on the other companies out there, it depends on us, and it depends on the users. I think, you know, that really remains to be seen.
Karen Norris asked, do they feel the audience for networks has, in the US or Europe at least, plateaued, and that it's all about deeper interaction now?
In the US, we have a sense that it is plateauing. Last month, we grew by 1 to 2 million. So it is still going up. But, you know, this redesign that we began back in September was because we were starting to sense or, you know, worry that we could plateau. It's you know, MySpace is so ubiquitous in the US that we just felt like everyone that knows about MySpace is on it. It hasn't statistically shown itself to be true, but I think there's some point where that will be the case. And so the redesign and really the thinking about what we wanted to do is very much about attracting a new audience, you know, making people that maybe weren't comfortable on a site like MySpace or thought that it was only for this or that type of person interested in what it was. So it's definitely something we think about more in the U.S., I think, than in other places, because we're stronger and have more people in the U.S. than anywhere else.
There were a couple of people, actually, that asked about target demographics, yeah, and, you know, which countries you target internationally. Any, yeah, comments about that?
Yeah, we basically look at the ad market and, you know, the size of the internet population and the broadband penetration there. I think MySpace would be quite boring or quite painful for you if you didn't have broadband, because people put so much rich media on their pages. So, you know, we look at those three factors and targeted them, you know, at the top. But now we've started to move into markets that definitely weren't in our first tier. So, you know, we just keep going.
That was Tom Anderson from MySpace responding to our listeners and our readers' questions. Jemima, what were some of the questions you didn't bring to him?
Oh, it's such a shame, isn't it, not being able to include all of them. And we did have some really good questions and some not so good questions. Why is their platform so awful? Sorry, I felt we should offer something slightly more constructive. Robin Waters asked, where does he see the most growth internationally? Alan Patrick wanted to know, what's the average CPM? I suspected he wouldn't be able to give too much granularity on that. Yeah. And somebody on Comment is Free asked, other social platforms have managed to attract older people to their site. Is MySpace interested in addressing that issue, and how?
Isn't Rupert Murdoch enough? I mean, he's quite old.
Does he actually have a profile? There's going to be
a
spoof one.
It's really
one.
Pimped up as well, isn't it?
Bling, bling, flashing, bling, bling.
Well, he's a very interesting guy, and Owen Gibson has actually done an in-depth story that's going to be in the media section on Monday, I believe.
Do you think that this revamp is going to put MySpace back into pole position?
It's just a few round corners. Let's not get too excited. It's still quite cluttered. It still doesn't have the simplicity of Facebook in its usability. Its strongest point, as some of those questions were getting at, is music, really. And if I was in charge of it, which I never will be, but if I was, then that's the road I'd go down.
We can write to the Make-A-Wish Foundation for you.
Thanks.
Many thank you, Jemima. And, of course, to Tom and to you, our demanding listeners. Most of you contacted the show via our Twitter feed, which is GuardianTW, and you can keep up to date on the whole Tech Weekly process by following us there. You can also read more about all of this on guardian.co.uk/technology and at blogs.guardian.co.uk/digital content. This weekend, London's Alexander Palace will host a meeting of the minds. Geek minds, to be precise. The BBC and The Guardian welcome techno nuts from around the country to put their crazy dreams into hard code during MASHED, the second annual festival of all things programmery. Jemima, you caught up with Matt Cashmore, one of the organisers of the event. What's going to happen and how will they take over the world?
Well, Matt's a development producer at the BBC. He has his fingers in some very interesting pies, including BBC Backstage and also Hacked, as it was last year, now called MASHED. He's got some great ideas, and I started by asking him what happened last year.
Well, last year we had the New York Times guys came along and they built this really funky little RFID reader on a mobile phone. And when you put it next to your computer, it pulled up the story in your computer that you were reading on your mobile phone. So that was quite handy. Not quite as much fun as the guys who built a blimp with a camera and a mobile and stuff attached to it, which was also quite cool. But my favourite hack last year has got to be the girl who did knitting patterns and recognition based on the knitting pattern. So you could knit yourself a jumper and the computer would do stuff based on that knitting pattern.
It all sounds very geeky. Who's really going to be there? Are these guys all the people who have their heads buried in computers all day?
Yeah, geeks. But, you know, geeks is such a broad brushstroke now that it's everybody from somebody who wants to mash up the BBC's traffic and travel data on a Google map as its most basic level, right through to people who want to come along and build a flight simulator and provide real-time data feeds out of the simulator for people to use over the weekend and build other stuff with.
So it's not really like a conventional conference. Can you explain a bit more about the format of the weekend?
Yes, it's definitely not a conventional conference. You turn up on the Saturday morning, you register, that much is normal, and then we've got talks from 10 o'clock to 1 o'clock. But those talks are all instructional, so it's kind of, this is how you get into the Slash Programs API, this is how you get into this bunch of data. The only kind of non-instructional talk we've got is a lady from NASA coming to talk about the next but one Mars rover, which is really cool. And then from there on in, it's just not a conference at all. It's basically you've got 24 hours to build something cool. So, you know, we show Doctor Who on the Saturday night, we've got Frankenstein at midnight on the Saturday night, there's popcorn, ice cream. It's a bit of a festival, but with a purpose.
So what happens to these clever things once people have built them?
Well, there's a bunch of different ways it can go. The New York Times guys took it back and did further development on it and used MASHED as an excuse to concentrate on one idea and then take it back into their standard kind of research and development cycle. So you get a large amount of work done in a very short period of time. And it's very esoteric, so you get very broad ideas within a very short period of time. So for people like the New York Times, for people like the BBC developers who took stuff along last year, like the iPlayer Facebook app, it goes back into the business and it goes through. But if you're an independent developer, what a better place to get spotted by the likes of Yahoo and Google and the BBC, all of whom are there this year.
What happens to those pieces of technology, though? I mean, is this a way for the BBC to get cheap development on the side?
No, absolutely not. I mean, it's IP neutral. So you bring something along, you build something into yours. If we want to do something with it, then it's up to us, alongside every other company that's at MASH, to come to you and say, OK, we want to do something with this and we'll pay you this much to do it. It's your idea. It's certainly not cheap from our point of view. In fact, it makes it slightly more complicated from our point of view to commission the ideas because it's an open public platform that anyone can take anything from.
So you're also doing something else a bit different. The conference, or unconference, a festival maybe, is at Alexandra Palace. Can you tell us a bit more about what you're broadcasting there?
We're broadcasting television from Alexandra Palace for the first time since the 1950s. And not only the first time since the 1950s we broadcast television from there, but we're broadcasting digital terrestrial television. So the first time Alexandra Palace has ever broadcast digital TV. And you'll actually be able to hack BBC One. We're putting out loads of USB dongles and a load of the guys from Interactive TV are coming along. We're going to teach you how to use MHEG, which is the programming language for Interactive TV. We're just going to try and kickstart a developer community around Interactive TV applications. So you'll actually be able to take BBC One and do stuff with it.
That was Matt Cashmore, co-organiser of this weekend's MASHED Festival in London. There are more and more of these geek events. happening around the country? What else is happening on the digital calendar? Bobby?
I'll shout out for Tech Weekly. We're going up to Manchester at the end of this week. So we're going to be at the Modern at the Urbis. That sounds very nice, doesn't
it? It is very fabulous.
At 4 p.m. on Thursday.
That's for our coffee and cake meetup.
So come along and we'll talk to you and maybe you can star in next week's show or something. But yeah, there's loads of this stuff. I mean, the game camp that we ran a couple of weeks ago, we're probably going to be doing several reruns, new versions of that over the coming year, maybe at the Interactive Festival, maybe
in
at
Edinburgh.
Game City, maybe at the London Games Fringe. So there's tons of that stuff going on and plenty of other conferences too.
The Develop Conference in Brighton is happening at the end of next month as well, which is a games-oriented conference. And the games blog is going to be there. We're going to be hosting a mighty game pub quiz where there will be prizes galore.
And
also, I'm trying to find out if we're going to be doing another Unfestival at the... Now, let me get this right. Media Guardian Edinburgh International Television Festival,
which
is on the last weekend of August, the bank holiday weekend. I wasn't there last year, but it was apparently very, very good. It's sort of not related to the main TV festival, but lots of interesting hackery and stuff going on there. So as soon as we find out if that's on again, we shall let you know.
Well, Bobby, you're going to be at MASH this weekend anyway. So we can expect to read all about it, blow by blow, on the website.
Yeah, it'll be coming through live as it happens. Even if lightning strikes, we're going to carry on.
Which is what happened last year.
Exactly.
So, and didn't people get rained on as well?
Yes. I'm going to be there too.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And Jemima's going to be there as well.
Yeah.
So we'll see it across the blogs. But speaking of blogs, what have you been saying on the blogs? Charles, what's caught your eye on the technology blog?
So far today, we haven't mentioned the Microsoft Yahoo thing where Microsoft is sort of given up. It's not entirely sure that Microsoft really has totally given up because there's still all the annual meeting, there's still Carl Icahn. So anyway, there was a big piece in the New York Times putting the knife into Yahoo's Jerry Yang, and Davis232 commented, if Yahoo is a declining company, as the piece in the New York Times suggested, then what motivated Microsoft to make an offer for it? And to put an alternative spin on the matter, isn't this a case of Microsoft mishandling the offer? I stopped taking this stuff seriously after the piece said, viewing employee retention as Microsoft's Achilles heel. Like Yang tries to protect the employees in the event of layoffs, and Jonah Serra, who wrote the piece, spins that into sabotage of the offer.
Icahn said, oh, maybe this Google thing all right, after all, you know, so
utter spaghetti. Yes, indeed. And over on the games blog, Greg has been wrestling with dual identities of dad and gamer. And in that, it was Father's Day on Sunday, last Sunday. He asked the games blog community which games that he should play while he's actually got a day off. And everybody and their uncle said Metal Gear Solid 4, which has received rave reviews. But what I quite liked was Wowzer 808. He says he didn't want to suggest something willy-nilly. We need a broader picture of this father character. What are his habits, his interests? Where does he eat? Where was he born? This will all help. At the moment, I'm sensing a 60-year-old man with absolutely no indications to suggest whatever game you buy him won't end up gathering dust.
He's got young kids, Keith, but that only makes him feel 60.
That's Greg. True. But well, both Greg and Keith have
yeah.
young children.
Well, I don't know. Have you seen Greg's byline photo?
He does.
Have a look on the blog. I don't know how old he is, but he comes from another planet. That's all.
He's got quite a frightening sort of blank canvas behind him, doesn't he? We love you, Greg. Anyway, Jemima, what's happening in digital content?
Yo. Okay, future journalism, women on the web, this whole women on the internet thing is still rumbling on. Yours truly was on this panel along with The Guardian's women's editor and also the women behind feministing.com and the F Word, who are fairly feisty women. But hearing some of their stories of some of the things that have been written in the comments feed on their website, just so horrific, I won't repeat them now, but I was really quite shocked and realised that in the world of sort of, you know, technology, because people have a corporate responsibility because they're involved in the business world. I don't really, thankfully, see much of that. So the comments for this were quite civilised. Steph Jones said, unfortunately, this does expose a very real problem of women and representation online. Observable right here on Comment is Free. Women bloggers and blogs that focus on women's issues attract such disproportionate vitriol and abuse. Some of it just very simply misogynist in nature and rarely even entering into constructive debate. While Aped said, internet chat rooms are scary things. But they're no more anti-women than they are anti-anything else. Get off your soapbox and look how nasty everyone is to everyone else. It's nothing to do with misogyny.
I have to say that I was very pleased to read the comments that came out of your post from that, because I've had...
Not mine. This was the lovely Caitlin.
Oh, right.
Simmons,
yes,
yeah.
But the several experiences of my own as a lady. And while technology may not receive as many vitriolic comments, games sure as heck does. And I have breasts. I know, it's amazing.
The thing is, I think saying it's all nasty out there, get used to it, is, you know, it's kind of just rolling over and accepting something horrible about human nature, isn't it? Yeah, okay, you may not think it's about misogyny, but it is actually about the misogyny of this number of people who come on, just as it would be about the racism of this number of people who arrive and start throwing around very horrible words and slanging each other. So I think, you know, just saying, well, deal with it, is just giving up. You know, why can't we have a better discourse on the internet? Why can't you get rid of those tossers who really annoy you and come on and do nothing but throw grenades in?
Well, I think the humanisation of the internet and sort of the way that things are becoming much more social and about real proper interactions has to be a really positive development and has to improve the level of debate that we have, because there are real connections and real people there.
And I actually
but that
imagine
makes it
that's
hurt
encouraging.
More as well, though. That's the problem.
But it does, I imagine but that's equally... encouraging more women on, because the social veil is sort of fallen, as it were.
You know, these commenters are always anonymous.
Pseudonymous. I mean, but the way that a lot of the social systems let you see what their comments have been in the round means that they can't sort of just hit and disappear. That if they've left a comment here, then you can find them, say, somewhere else. I mean, the Guardian site uses a system called Plurk, where you can see where what people have written all over the site. And you can
Plurk's the Twitter-esque visualization tool.
Oh, my consonants in the wrong place.
Oh, too many.
So it's...
Web 2 names are plenty.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to stop this conversation here. There is a lot more to be said, and if you'd like to continue the conversation, you can do. Please do at blogs.guardian.co.uk/games/technology/digital-content. Or you can email us at tech@guardian.co.uk. There are a plethora of options for your communicating pleasure.
In this week's tech section with The Guardian, the iPhone, new BlackBerry, LG Secret, and other new phones that are battling for the smartphone title. They all incorporate touchscreens, but do people need them? We compare the features and prices. Free Our Data reports on the government's reversal of its former position and now backs free reuse of public sector information and a move to lower the cost to use data. We review the Flip, the £100 iPod of camcorders, and decide it's definitely a very, very good buy. And we report on how people who put concert pictures on Flickr found someone illegally selling them on eBay, as well as claiming the copyright and raking in thousands of pounds. It's all in Thursday's tech section with The Guardian.
That's just about it for this week, but I'd like to thank our numerous guests, including Kevin Rose, Tom Anderson, and Matt Cashmore. Thanks as well to Bobby, Jemima, and Charles, plus our producer, Scott. Next week, we'll be switching on The Baby, the very first programmable computer up in Manchester. So join us in Manchester on Thursday if you can, or catch you at the same time next week. I'm Alex Krotowski. See you next Tuesday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.